Do you still feel like a stranger in your own country?
Sometimes I do. I think I've obviously lived in Tanzania, but I also spent several years living in Europe. And so there's always a part of me that will remain in other places, and home has been this fluid concept for me. I think in many ways Montana will always be one of my homes, but home is many places for me. And there are some things about being American. Of course, it's comfortable here. I understand it. I fit in here in ways I don't in other places. But there are some aspects of it that still feel a bit odd to me and make me feel a little bit like a fish out of water.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Juliet Cutler about Among the Maasai, a memoir about her work educating girls in Tanzania. Stay with us. When people ask you, why bring Western education to developing nations? How do you answer that?
That's a hard question. And I think one I've struggled with, one that I address in the book. I think sometimes we operate under the assumption that culture is a static thing, and it's not. Culture is something that's always changing. Our own culture, the Maasai culture, certainly is changing. And I think really this school came about because some Maasai elders saw the ways in which their culture was changing as the 21st century approached. This school was established in 1995. And so they saw globalization, the approaching technology and cell phones. Now, if you go to Tanzania, you'll see the Maasai herding their cattle and goats while talking on cell phones. Yeah. And so that piece was coming. And they knew that they needed to raise up a new generation of leaders. And they saw education as a pathway to this. And so the impetus for the school really came from them. And research in the field of international development really bears out that education is transformative, particularly for women and girls who live on the margins where poverty and violence are prevalent. So I've supported education very simply because of that, because of its power to transform the lives of women and girls.
It's true, you address power, privilege, and colonization multiple times and in multiple frames within the book. At one point you write, I found myself frequently wondering how well-intentioned people in the West, like me and other short-term volunteers, could best help the Maasai or Tanzanians in general. How have you grappled with, you know, maybe even over the last couple decades, what is the value of short-term volunteering, long-term volunteering, and what's the best way to make a contribution?
Another great question. I think one of the pieces of learning that I've taken away from my time in Tanzania, which has now spanned 20 years because I return almost annually, and so I've had that experience of being on the ground for 2 years, sort of in a long-term position, but also dropping in from time to time in the last few years, and what does that mean? And I think sort of my philosophy has been embodied by a Swahili phrase that is bega kwa bega, which is, it translates as shoulder to shoulder. And so one of my pieces of learning is that local people already know the issues that they face. They have the solutions and are best equipped to implement those solutions. Often what they lack is the resources to do that work. And so, though it's not always easy for Westerners, our role is really not to come in and lead. And we frequently come in with our timelines and our outcomes and our budgets, and that's not always the way things work in other places. And so I have always come in as a listener and as a follower. And that's sort of naturally, I think, who I am. So it came naturally to me to do that and to really empower local people on the ground. And one of the really rewarding pieces is 20 years later, some of my students are those leaders on the ground now who are doing the work. And so it has been really important to me to support the work that they are doing rather than to come with my own agenda. And I think that that applies whether you're going short-term or long-term. If you're going short-term, I think it's really important to have a local partner on the ground who has that kind of a philosophy and not to just show up. I talk in the book about a group showing up to paint classrooms that had recently been painted because the school didn't really have another short-term project for them and without a lot of awareness about the culture that they'd dropped into. And so just doing your homework before you go someplace, I think, is really important.
You run into multiple conflicts in the book, and one of them you reach early on in which you had been given permission to complete your master's thesis on your teaching methods while you were there. And one of the diocese officials, out of fear that you might be doing, you know, more outsider research on their people, tries to halt you. And in response to that, you had written, "Today I realized my nationality, gender, race, and age defined my role in ways I'd never experienced. I had many strikes against me. I was a foreigner. I was a woman. I was white, and I was young. It was the first time in my life I felt absolutely powerless to change my circumstance." And I wanted to know, how did you move through the tension, you know, of that moment? How did you, you know, what was your sense of conviction, or how did you grapple with that?
Well, I think that that was the first time in my life, we use this phrase a lot these days, but that my privilege was checked. That I recognized I did bring privilege because of my nationality, because of the color of my skin, because of my socioeconomic status. And when you're in a different context, sometimes the rules don't apply the same way that they do in your context. And that was the case here, where being young, elders really rule culturally among almost all the cultural groups in Tanzania. That is true. Males, it's a very patriarchal culture, the Maasai specifically are. And so I recognized that all the privilege and the rights that I had assumed were mine in this context, those rules didn't apply anymore. And so I think maybe that was the first moment when I thought, I really am going to have to listen and follow here even more than sort of is natural for me in order to be successful. And so that's really what I did. I found local mentors who also walked me through that. It wasn't as if that experience happened and then all of a sudden I went, okay, now the rules have changed and I understand how to operate here. That was a lesson I had to learn the hard way many times. But it was those mentors who would sit with me and sort of help me understand the context and why things were as they were.
And here we are decades later, and you've written this memoir in response, you know, to your whole experience. Why write the book now?
Well, so the book started as an effort to make sense of the experience. I talk in the book about what it was like to come back to the States after having had this experience, which profoundly changed me, and to walk back into a culture where I was perceived as sort of the same person I was when I left. And I started writing in order to really make sense of what this experience meant to me, to put words to it. That took me a long time. And so in part, it's coming out now because it took me that long to process what this experience meant. And then I sat on the manuscript once it was done for a couple of years, not really sure if I wanted to release it into the world, in many ways not really trusting what the world might do with it. And also because I am so sensitive to these ideas of race and privilege and what my role in all this has been. And I didn't want this to be another book about a white person who goes to Africa and saves people. I really wanted it to be true and authentic to what the experience had been. And in many ways, this experience saved me more than I saved anyone there. So I had a lot of sort of reflecting to do on if I wanted this to be in the world. And some mentors here in the States, and even in Tanzania, many people in Tanzania have read it, read the manuscript, were encouraging me along the way, like, this is a really powerful story. It needs to be in the world. And so then once I decided, okay, let's do that, then it took me a while to find a publisher and go through that whole process. So That's why now, and I think that there is some real value in having 20 years of retrospect to look back on what the experience was, and that me as a 45-year-old woman has a lot different impressions than I did as a 25-year-old woman.
I want to move into talking about relationships. There are two older American couples who take you under their wing while you live there, and I wanted to know what it meant to you to have these surrogate parents in Marv and Jean and Linda and Doug. And did you see yourself and Mark, who became your husband, did you see yourself in their image?
They were wonderful. They were and are wonderful friends and mentors to us there. I mean, we had Tanzanians, of course, who were our mentors as well. But because these two almost parent figures were of our culture in a different place, they also understood the challenges that we faced and so were really present for us as counselors. And so that meant a great deal to us to have them there. I think there are friendships that are tested by fire. And so these two couples, certainly these are friendships that have been tested by fire. And so I, of course, valued their advice, their counsel always. I mean, too, I think that just the characters you meet in foreign places, like, I don't know, I think working sometimes abroad attracts a certain personality, but both of these couples, wonderful sense of humors, you know, so in the midst of sort of sometimes difficult circumstances, the ability to just laugh and also laugh at ourselves, just sort of the absurdity sometimes of the things that would happen to us or even sort of our own culture.
I want to talk about Linda and Doug in a moment, but before that, you reference your own transformation when you flew home to America and got married. And there was a distinct moment you write about where you say you felt as if you'd floated through the event as two separate people.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that? And can you talk a little bit about it?
Yeah, so I think sometimes when we're in public spaces, like at weddings, that we're surrounded by friends and family, we put on a certain persona, right? And so I think there was this persona of who my friends and family knew me to be and expected me to be, and the way you're expected to behave at weddings in the United States when you're the bride. And so that was the piece of me walking back into my own culture. And yet there was this other part of me that was uncomfortable with that, that recognized I wasn't that same person anymore, and that while these people were all there to support me and to show their love for me, there was a part of me that they didn't know now. And a part of me that at that point in time, I really was having trouble articulating. I mean, I'd only been in Tanzania a year. We came back in between our 2 years to get married. And so there were all these experiences that I had, all these people I had met, and I didn't know really how to talk about that. And so there was this other part of me who had in many ways started this metamorphosis, and I didn't know how to show that or how to even talk about that. And that carried through when we returned to live in the U.S. I sometimes talk about that first year we were back. I have very few memories of that first year we were back. And I think that that is in part because I went into a depression. I didn't know sort of how to be anymore in this space and how to talk about what had happened.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Juliet Cutler about her memoir, Among the Maasai. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. after the wedding, you return to Tanzania and you and Mark go on a trip with Linda, who says, "What could be more fun than honeymooning with your quasi-parents?" But you get in the car together and you come across something that has made an imprinting on you. And I was hoping that you would read from that section of the book and also talk about it a little bit beforehand.
Sure. So when we came back from the U.S., they held a reception for us in Monduli, which is the town where we lived. So all the teachers at both of the schools we taught at were at this reception. And they also saw Doug and Linda and Marv and Jean as our quasi-parents. And so in Tanzania, at a wedding, you have a head table where the bride and groom sit and their parents sit there as well. So we had Doug and Linda on one side and Marv and Jean on the other side. And after that event, Doug and Linda took us on a short safari to Lake Manyara, which wasn't very far from where we were living. And we drove around. And so I'll read you a little bit of that, because I talk in it a little bit about what that place, Lake Manyara, is about. Though far from home, I found a certain kinship with Tanzania's terrain and the wildlife it revealed. It reminded me of my childhood in Montana, where the Great Plains housed bison instead of buffalo, and I searched out antelope instead of impala, where grizzly bears and mountain lions reminded me that I was not, in fact, all-powerful and invincible, as lions and leopards did here. As we left the park to visit what we'd heard from other expatriates was the best t-shirt shack on the safari circuit, we cranked up Aretha Franklin and rolled down the windows. Doug and Linda bobbed and swayed along in the front seat, and I smiled at Mark, who sat next to me in the back, tapping his foot to the music. For the first time in months, I felt carefree and relaxed. Perhaps this should have served as a warning, but it wasn't until Doug slowed the vehicle that I noticed a bike lying in the road, askew, the back wheel bent and broken. What I saw next would forever mar this short pseudo-honeymoon, our breezy, wistful adventure giving way to an image that would indelibly sear itself into our memories of Lake Manyara.
That moment becomes a shocking moral dilemma for you as you end up seeing the body of a child on the side of the road. And in response to that, you had then written, "Beyond this moment, I no longer lived in the realm of tidy morals and self-righteous intentions. I was no hero, no savior." Because you had to make the choice not to stop and help. And I just wanted to know, what did you learn about yourself in that moment?
I think there were several moments in my experience in Tanzania, and this was probably the most powerful one, where I realized how little control over big moral issues I had. You know, some problems are so big and vast that as one person, we can't necessarily address them. And sometimes the conditions in which we find ourselves make solving a problem impossible. And this was one of those times. There were other times as well. So how do you, as someone who's come to help and make a difference, come to terms with the fact that sometimes you can't save everyone? There are people beyond your reach. There are situations beyond your control. And so I think after that, I really began to focus on what I could control, which was showing up in the classroom, doing a good job, empowering these students as best I could. And it's not that that experience on that road with the boy didn't haunt me and doesn't still haunt me. You know, I've thought a lot based on this experience about the parable of the Good Samaritan, which is probably one of the best known parables in the Bible. And, you know, so for those of us who go to church, you know, we hear this parable and think, oh, we got to stop. There's this boy on the side of the road. We got to stop. But what happens when you can't stop? And what happens when you find sort of on the metaphorical road so many broken people, so many people in need, that you can't help them all. Certainly, I think I sought to help the ones that I could, but I also started to ask the larger question of how do we transform the road so that we don't find so many people broken and beaten on it. And so for me, education of girls was that way to transform that road. And so that has been where my focus has been, is on transforming the road and helping those that I can along the way, recognizing that oftentimes the need is so great that even with the means that I have, I can't help everyone.
You've mentioned the students, and you tell the stories of Nangida, Miriam, and Dina in the book, and I was wondering if you would pick one of those that you might like to just give us a snapshot of.
So Miriam's story is a really dramatic story. She had the support of her father to attend school, but he died before she could get to secondary school. And then her brother took over as head of the household. So in the Maasai culture, when a girl gets to puberty, she is circumcised, and then her father, or in this case her brother, arranges a marriage for her. The Maasai still practice polygamy, so sometimes this is to a man who's much older than her, maybe has a second or a third wife. So circumcision for girls is illegal in Tanzania, and it's a human rights violation, though it's still something that's commonly practiced among the Maasai. So Miriam's brother arranged a marriage for her and actually received the cattle, which is a bride price that the husband would pay. And at that point, Miriam ran away from home. And she is tenacious enough that she finds her way to Dodoma, which is the capital of Tanzania, and finds a member of parliament who she's heard on the radio talking about the importance of girls' education. This member of parliament happens to be a Maasai man as well. And when she finds him, she tells him her story, and he finds a place for her at school. She eventually graduates and thinks it's safe to go back, and in fact, it's not safe yet because her brother still owes this man cattle or a bride. And so in very dramatic fashion, the police are involved, as are local politicians, in negotiating her release, if you will, from her home, and she does eventually finish school. But her story is not an atypical story for many Maasai girls, but she had a particular determination in her belief in the importance of education that she would, I mean, I can't even imagine at my age approaching a senator or a congressperson to tell them my story and beg for a position at school, but she did this, and that's really amazing.
Part of this book is that all the proceeds go to help Maasai girls go to school, and I am hoping you can talk a little bit about what that looks like on the ground and what your role is now.
Yeah, so all proceeds from the sale are going back to two nonprofit organizations, both of which are supporting different aspects of this work. If you're interested in learning more, you can visit my website about that, julietcutler.com. But I'll talk a little bit about the work. So one of the pieces of learning, and this came from local leader, Dr. Msinjili, who's been an educator in Tanzania for, I think, almost 50 years now. He recognized that it wasn't enough just to give a girl a scholarship. If she didn't feel safe at school, and if she wasn't safe at home, then she probably wasn't going to finish school even with a scholarship. And so he created a safe house where girls like Miriam, and Miriam was one of the early participants in the safe house, where girls like Miriam can go if they can't go home. And it provides sort of all kinds of support to these girls, including counseling and healthcare. Some of the girls who are in the safe house have learning disabilities. in Tanzania, there's really no safety net for kids who come to school with a learning disability. And in a system where you have to pass a national exam to continue to the next level, these girls just can't pass those exams, and then they're sort of left with a now what question. So the Safe House has also been a place that's provided some technical training to those kinds of girls in different schools. It also provides support to girls like Dina, whose story I didn't tell, but Dina was raped, got pregnant, and in Tanzania, girls who are pregnant are permanently expelled from school. Also, a national law, which amazingly was just overturned in the last month, so that's the good news. But for Dina, she needed some additional support. So for girls who have gotten pregnant, the Safe House is a place where they can get support as well. So that's one aspect of the program. And then another aspect is led by a local nonprofit it's based in Arusha, called Mwangaza. And they go into schools and give teachers some extra tools in their toolkit to address these issues of safety. Again, without the same sort of social safety net that we have here around social workers and counselors, law enforcement even, who address these issues of violence that girls face. Teachers are left to deal with those issues in Tanzania. And so the training that they get really helps them to work with students to address some of those issues of safety. And unfortunately, many girls are preyed upon at boarding schools too. And so just how do we create a safe school environment as well? And then the other piece of work that Mwangaza is doing is the Binti Mama program. The Binti Mama program, that translates as daughter-mother. We would say it mother-daughter in English, but it brings together mothers and daughters in a community-based program to talk about the issues that they face and possible solutions to those issues. They're getting ready to launch a parallel program for fathers and sons to discuss their roles in creating safe families and communities as well. So that's the ongoing work that's still happening now around issues of safety. Of course, the work of providing scholarships at the Maasai Girls School is still happening as well.
Juliet Cutler currently lives near Atlanta. In addition to writing, she's an educator and designer of award-winning exhibits for museums, parks, and cultural centers throughout the world. She returns to Tanzania annually. Look for more information about her work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin's studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.